There's never been an otter start.
Otter?
To a otter. I'm not being cute about that, but
we're eating mussels on it.
I wish we were. No, instead, we are in a creepy basement.
Yet. Oh, yeah.
That I approve of because the audio is good.
Yeah.
Which is the most important thing, honestly.
Yeah. The video on this episode
is non-existent.
Amazing. I look good. Fantastic.
You don't have to see my eye watering the entire time. Got suntan lotion in it. Scratched cornea.
No, did you really? Oh,
don't do that.
Huh.
Well, yeah. I need to tell everybody that we're in a basement.
We are.
And
dungeon?
A little bit.
Could be. Sometimes.
Just it's a little bit dungeony. It seems appropriate though for our guest today.
Yeah, I agree.
Which means I'm gonna tell you, welcome aboard the Funny Boat Podcast.
Ahoy, ahoy.
With us, it's my co-host, the broker with the beard. How you doing, Cap?
Not fabulous and fuzzy faced.
No, I'm over that. Oh, I've given up on that.
I kind of really like that
intro. I'm so sorry. We'll bring it back.
Okay.
I am your for real host, Captain Boomies. You can find me everywhere at CaptainBoomies.com. Yeah, uh-huh. But today, we have, honestly, a sailor that's very near and dear to my heart.
Yes.
Because he's been there through all of the darkest times in my sailing career. And I wish I was kidding about that, but this man has genuinely been there to tell me funny things when I thought it was all over. We have Captain John Schaefer. Ooh. He is a phenomenon, a boat floater extraordinaire, a captain that I look to when I'm trying to 100% abide by safety standards.
Mm-hmm.
And also Mr. Safety Standards on the internet.
Yeah.
He is known as the Ministry of Sailing on the internet. Captain John Schaefer, how you doing?
I'm good. It's good to see you again. Good to see you as well, Ed.
Yes, sir.
The broker with a beard. This is going to be fun.
Welcome aboard. So, okay, we are in a bit of an odd situation. Normally, I like to do these podcasts somewhere nautical, somewhere beautiful, but I couldn't pull that off today because it's so rainy and disgusting. We were originally going to do this on a houseboat in Canton, and it's just too gross out.
Yeah, it is. It was a little drippy out
there. Sorry, y'all.
It is.
I'm not willing to be out in the rain with my very expensive recording equipment, so instead I have dragged my favorite inside. Sorry. Stop giving me that face. Don't look at me like that. Anyway, Mr. John Schaefer is who I talk to about things like what should my contract look like for a delivery agreement? How should I charge for an unusual delivery contract? Where do I need to put clauses that say, hey, this is the safety equipment that if is not available to me, I am done.
Right.
This is the man that I go to. I think it's a really important conversation to have if you're a professional mariner, but it's also an important conversation to have if you own a boat and you pay for professional mariners.
Right?
So
absolutely.
This is why I want to talk to you, John Schaefer.
So let's blame John.
And blame me on everything.
Everybody. Here we go.
Hey, if you want to blame me, you got to take a number, get in line.
All right, John. John, you recently did a very interesting delivery. You went all the way from Pensacola.
Yeah.
To, oh, I've totally forgotten, but it's somewhere in the Northeast.
Yeah. All the way up to Mamaroneck Yacht Club.
Wow.
Long Island.
Long Island.
Sound. Did you know nobody from Long Island says Long Island?
I mean, I'm kind of from Long Island.
Oh, went to school there, heard it a lot.
Apparently it's a hard G.
The poor people.
Yeah. Oh my, yeah.
No. Yeah. Okay. So if you want to get a contract, don't.
Yeah.
Like, listen for the guh. is what we're saying. God, are we racist? Is that what's happening right now?
No, against Long Islanders? This is just stereotypical.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Most stereotypes happen because they're true, you know.
Oh, lordy, lordy. Okay, so I have long been a delivery captain at this point, and I learn all the time things that should and shouldn't be in my contract. But I feel like you, every time I talk to you, you tell me, oh, yeah, that should totally be in your contract. It's you're been in mine since the beginning.
You're
always surprised that I don't already have it. So you must have learned this from somewhere, or did you learn it just from experience?
I probably change my contract every time I get off a boat.
So wait a minute.
It's a learning experience.
So you guys do contracts?
Yeah, it kind of helps getting paid. Yeah. I don't do it for fun.
No. So people think that our job is just fun. And we are delivery captains. We do take your boat from A to B. And don't get me wrong. There's some amount that's fun. But it's also a job. It's work. And there's a reason people pay us to do it. And it's because they don't want to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. It's hours. It's days. It's effort that they don't want to put in.
This last one. Oh, I'm telling you. It was a trooper. A day sailor. 32-foot trimaran. 32-foot day sailor trimaran from Pensacola to New York about... almost 2,000 miles. Yeah, with no AIS and no radar. Pretty much took the shore all the way in, going from sea breeze to shore breeze, land breeze, trying to stay within a mile or two of the coast, surfing up. But you got to go 14 knots in this boat. So
14 knots in a sailor.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Wow, so it's a great boat.
What was your best day on that delivery? I mean, like speed / just day in general.
14-4, definitely the best day. Code zero up, main full up, wind. I probably shouldn't say how it was. It came down about an hour and a half later.
Right.
You know, at one point we were double headed, so we had the jib up and the code zero and the main, and we're just flying through the ocean.
Okay, we have a handful of power boaters that listen to us. Let me explain this. So he's saying that he was flying not only a forward sail, but he was flying like the little weird forward sail that is smaller and lighter, but really weirdly big and made of material that NASA scientists would be very jealous of.
Yeah.
And
super light.
An additional bullshit sail just to get the job done. So he's going downwind, tits out, no problem, flying as fast as he can. And in the day sailor that he's in, he's doing 14 knots. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Which I know some power boats that would be jealous of that.
Oh, like, yeah. Passed quite a few of them. Oh, yeah. But at the same time, I'm not going to take this into a storm. And the storms last week coming off the East Coast were nuts. The Cape.
Yeah. The past 2 weeks, it's been
crazy.
A couple gnarly ones rolling through.
So we spent 2 hours between two massive thunderstorms. One was between Jacksonville. The other one's between Cape Canaveral. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're right in between 2 hours just going back and forth, you know, just waiting for a break. And then, you know, somebody else is out there, their sails are gone, their engines are gone, the Coast Guard's doing a rescue. So I'm listening to that on the radio. We're in the same stuff they are, kind of. And It's like, all right, guys, we're just going to minimize the risk here. Stay in between these two storms. When it clears, we'll see how far north we can go. And so pretty much that's it cleared up. And, you know, staying inshore like that gives us the ability to keep looking at the weather applications.
Yeah.
Predict wind is great. You know, pulling off the radar was absolutely fantastic. So we can track the storms on the radar and just try to stay our best between them. And actually, we did that the entire trip. So we just duck in when we can, sit and rest, put it on the hook.
Right.
Look, I'm not surprised that you survived a pretty gnarly delivery. I'm not surprised because I know who you are. I mostly know who you are because you are also the guy that I talk to whenever I want to talk about marine safety standards.
Yeah.
So Ministry of Sailing and John Schaefer in particular is the guy who is a authority on marine safety standards for things like pulling bodies out of the water. And mm-hmm. I don't mean dead bodies. That's easy. I mean people who are still strapped in and tethered on, and they need to be lifted out of the water. This right. is a wild and difficult process.
That is mostly unpracticed.
That is yeah. unpracticed. You're 100% right.
It is and mostly unpracticed.
Yeah. It's all great to read about it and kind of, in your head, know a general consensus of mm-hmm. what I'm supposed to do, but usually the person in the water hasn't read that.
Yeah,
and so yeah, it's
difficult.
That's one of the biggest things we had going back to my Merchant Mariner days. Just going out there and doing the thing. Oh yeah, all I have to do is put on the suit and hop into that life raft. No problem. Oh my gosh, totally different. And
then
to be pulled back on board a boat. I mean, in open water? Wow.
And it's very difficult. And so what we try to say, and we try to encourage people to realize that a man overboard drill has three phases. Phase one is a boat maneuverability exercise, getting the boat to the person. Mm-hmm. There's lots of techniques. They're all over the internet. That's only phase one. Phase two is attaching the person somehow to the boat with the line.
Right.
That's only phase two. And most of the time people do a man overboard drill, you know, they throw the fender over the body, you know, overboard, and, you know, they recover it and they attach it, pull
the
it up with the boat,
easy to pick up.
you know, and that, you know, that's just only phase one and phase two. But the actual practice of getting a person out of the water, now, even if it's a athlete, pro, whatever, it's still going to be difficult mm-hmm. because, you know, when you're on a moving dance floor. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The space it takes to get a person on board, it takes three people usually to pull them up if you're not using any leverage devices like yeah. a main sheet or a halyard. All right. And then you're going to be working in a space where you're on top of each other. It's like yeah. literally standing on a picnic table and trying to pick a full-grown person off of the ground by standing off the picnic while they're laying down.
A wet, full-grown person.
And they may weigh twice as much depending on what kind of gear they're wearing, right? And so it is an exercise. And, you know, to this day, people are still, oh, we're just going to pull them off back to the swim ladder. Well, the conditions are such that they're off the boat. The conditions are probably such that if you bring them to the back of the boat, a heaving boat might crush their person. So you have to have those places designated and practiced on your boat and how you're going to do it. And those are procedures. And it's not a procedure unless it's written down and practiced. Yeah. And that's where most people make the mistakes is they just do phase one and phase two. And they don't have a plan to pull a person out of the water.
Yeah. And it makes me think of Mike Tyson when he said, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth.
Yeah.
And that just sounds a lot like that, right?
That mm-hmm. is such a good analogy.
Yeah, and that has to be part of a plan and a safety plan. I mean, and when I take people out and we're coaching them, the first thing we do, we're out in the water. We teach them how.
Do you throw somebody overboard?
Oh,
man, I would do that.
You know, the times I would like to are... We can
but
talk
they're
about.
The one I'm teaching, so
we can talk about it. Just happened the other day.
Well,
go up front and tune the radar. There's no radar on this boat.
Okay, so this brings me to most sailors. I would say that their boat isn't even equipped to help them pull somebody out of the water. Like, the crew isn't equipped to handle.
Yeah.
A full speed haul out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
That being said, a zero-speed haul out of the water is different.
Right.
But you tend to deal with the performance vessels, mm-hmm. the high-speed vessels, mm-hmm. the really cool stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, let me throw my hair back over the shoulder and feel really sexy about it.
If I had hair, I would do that.
Mm. Yeah, well, so we have the certification for a sailing rescue swimmer that we've developed, which is really hot right now. Because, you know, some boats, if you just follow the traditional figure eight, you know, whatever you want, you know, some boats just don't slow down. You take all their sails down, and if it's windy enough, they're still doing 8 knots.
Because mm-hmm. they're hot as hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're doing what they were designed to do.
I mean, the boat I was just taking on, it weighed 6,000 pounds. That was it. You know,
it's not going to
go upwind at all. I mean, you know, my high speed upwind performance on that and 3 feet wave was, you know, 2.5 knots. The boat just stops. It's like, well, we can't do that. Time to crack off and go, you know? So there are going to be occasions and there are incidents of which it was just so hard to maneuver a high performance boat that the boat even hit somebody and hurt them even more and injured them, or they just couldn't get the person close to the boat whatsoever. And so that's why we developed a certification for a rescue swimmer, because more and more pros are using that, and we just don't want people to go out and try it on their own. When we have professionals that have done it, we brought in the Coast Guard rescue swimmers, the PJ Air Force guys, and we put together a program to do that. And our next phase is for everybody.
I'm so excited.
Believe how cool this is.
I know. Are you allowed to talk about it?
I can talk about it.
Okay.
Oh, my good. God.
Thank goodness. Filming this summer. We're filming this summer because you've seen it.
This is coming to a theater near you.
I'm coming to you now. And so here's the hints. Okay, you ready for this one?
Yeah.
How many times you're on the water and you see sailboats, catamarans, even powerboats with massive freeboards on them.
Mm-hmm.
And like the only way to pull people in the water is going to be off the back of their boat, right?
Absolutely. Right. Every time.
And I don't care if that boat is 40 feet long, and I don't care if it's 140 feet long. With so much freeboard, it's going to be really difficult, right?
I agree.
But those same boats have inflatable surfboards on them.
Ooh.
And so you can buy now rescue surfboards that are 12 feet long with handles all over them. And now, instead of a person's body weight being fully immersed in the water, even a person with limited mobility with all the handles on this can help themselves up. And now you've got their body weight out of the water. And so we're developing techniques and procedures to start using all of those inflatable surfboards.
Oh my God, I love this.
As rescue devices. And so now imagine the worst case scenario. Yeah. A couple.
Yeah.
And one of the persons on the boat can't get the other person out of the water, but they are able to retrieve them, right?
Mm-hmm.
The person with minimal mobility can at least get them out of the water and give them a greater chance of survivability when they're on top of a board.
Yeah.
Sure. Now they can kneel, or now they might be able to stand.
Oh my
depending
God.
On sea state. Right.
Gives them a break.
So now we're giving longer opportunities for other boats to come in and rescue and help people out, but also we're minimizing the amount of weight that's in the water, so we can pull the center of gravity up so much higher
right.
that you can hook a halyard on.
Sure.
You could do something else. And so we're modifying one now that if you just hook it up to a halyard, the basket pulls up and it holds a person in like a stretcher, just hoist it right up on your back.
When I'm thinking about this, every catamaran I've chartered,
yeah,
if it had a inflatable stand up paddleboard that had handles that could do this.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I would have used.
Yeah. So our encouragement is going to be, if you're going to buy one that the offshore surf rescues guys are using, because it has the handles all over it.
Because it has the handles.
And then you can use it as a backboard. You can use it all kinds of stuff. It's all ready to go.
Wow.
It doesn't weigh anything. Your boat can land on
it. It weighs nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fun to play with if you don't, you know, more use it. So we're going to be filming procedures and concepts on that this summer, and it's going to be fun. So we're really developing that. We got a partner organization that we're doing it with. They gave us a paddleboard to work with, and I think that's going to be revolutionizing. I hope so for people that are out there. And the Ministry of Sailing is working hard on giving people choices and options for rescue.
And that's the, I think that's the, really the biggest thing is, well, having the options and then being, having that information in front of you too.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
How to do it and what to do. So how would somebody, like you're saying, you're filming that this summer. How is that accessed?
Well, of course,
potentially.
Of course, on the Ministry of Sailing YouTube channel. Okay.
Awesome.
Sorry. Speaking of the Ministry of Sailing YouTube channel, you are not a favorite of some YouTube sailing channels because you've called them out for safety things that you have objected to. What has been the backlash for that?
Minimal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Minimal. I mean, because you know, the data is there. Because you can argue with me all you want, because that's something different. But I don't say it's my opinion. It's not my opinion. I just use the offshore special regulations from World Sailing. All right, there are standards out there for sailing, and if you were to pick them, I think the highest one is the offshore special regulations. And all I do is point out, well, according to the offshore special regulations, yeah, maybe you shouldn't make your own tether. You might save yourself some money.
Right.
All right. But, you know, there are standards and there are case studies that tell you the reasons not to. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, a tether made appropriately has a load-bearing tag on it. And if it's stretched, you know that it's been compromised. And if you make your own, you don't have that. Australia tends to lead the way when it comes to safety. Mm-hmm. And their rules are, you know, you have, well, in case you're being dragged, you have this quick release to snap. No longer in Australia. If you're dragging in the water, you're not hooked up right.
Mm.
The tether is to keep you on the deck of
the boat. So it has to be short enough to keep you on board.
Or you have to do your jack lines in a way that it keeps you from falling off. I mean, I always see people, like one of the guys I called out was, and you know, we have the jack lines running in the stern of the vessel, so if you're driving the boat, you're just clipping from behind.
So you could be hanging off the back of the boat.
Bingo.
Yeah. Or they'll run the jack lines up the, you know, the walkway.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
instead of center line, whatever.
Another guy. And this way I could pull myself up in case I'm done. You know that it only takes 4 knots of speed to hold a person dragging a boat under the water.
Is that all?
Yeah. Studies have shown that. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I did that same study as a kid trying to learn how to water skate.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it's as high as 4 knots.
Yeah. So I have called out, you know, YouTube channels trying to kill you. Part one and part two.
Right.
And I toned it down because I was going to call it idiots.
Right.
And I didn't want to offend anybody by doing that.
Sure. Well, because, I mean, I think about sailing as a kid, and I think about what felt safe when I was a kid versus what I know is safe as a professional mariner, having done a lot more safety classes, having done a lot more safety drills as an adult. What I thought as a kid is such bullshit.
Oh my gosh. There's a term for that in the risk management industry. It's called risk tolerance.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, and I'll give you a real life example. My first time, hold on to your hats, in Afghanistan in Kabul in 2001, I went there, and within the first week, I thought it was the most dangerous place in the planet.
Mm-hmm.
By the second week, you know, we're having parties by the swimming pool.
Right.
You know, has the risk changed?
Yeah.
No.
I
got used to it.
Yeah.
So I started getting tolerance based on the risk level that was there. And that's what happens to a lot of people.
Interesting.
Right. Nothing's happened to me before. So therefore, I think the past is going to have the absolute ability to predict the future.
How did I go the opposite way? As a kid, I thought I was invulnerable. And then the older I got, I felt like the more and more I needed safety standards to help me protect not only myself, but my crew, the vessel itself, my insurance company, Good Lord, my insurance company.
That's because your frontal cortex as an adult is the last thing. And that's where your risk and your fear comes from. That frontal cortex is the last to develop, and it develops longer in men.
Okay. There we, now I know. Okay. That makes a lot of sense, actually. Okay, so how did this become your passion? That's my next question.
You know, I wanted to be a fireman when I was a child.
That's so cute. Oh my God, really?
So I kind of lived my entire life having a desire to protect and help people. And so that's why my career started, you know, doing that with all the humanitarian security projects I did. I mean, I've traveled to every war zone in the world since 1987.
Rest.
Providing security for the less vulnerable and for organizations that go into war zones to serve the vulnerable populations. Yeah. So I've been doing that my whole life, and just I've been sailing my whole life too. So the two just merged together.
I remember. Okay. So we have a mutual friend.
Yeah.
And I remember once upon a time, he told me that you invited him to a very interesting job. And that job was to help vessels passing through the Suez Canal avoid pirates.
Yes.
Ooh, yeah. So this sounds like the most risk that I could possibly think of. And you are Mr. Anti-Risk. So how do you explain your relationship with... what sounds like the most high risk job in boating that I could possibly think of, which is anti-pirate stuff in the Suez Canal, and extreme training on the other side of how to help sailors at sea.
So that's simple. That's part of the mitigation process. All right.
So
you identify what the risks are, right? But then what are the mitigating factors? Like an insurance policy can be a mitigating factor. You can transfer, something bad happens, you don't lose that, so that's it. Procedures and policy are also mitigating factors. And part of that is also awareness. So awareness, like my next YouTube is going to be, is it a sailboat or a serial killer? And it's going to be about building awareness of those things and using statistics that hurt you. But more often than not, it's training. It's training in those situations that brings out greater mitigation. And so the better you get, the more you train in it, the better you're going to have to mitigate those risks. And so when you're relying on your training in dangerous situations, or if things might be questionable, you can fall back to the training when you have it. The worst is not to have the training, not to have the awareness, and not have the policies and procedures. And so that's what we try to do, is we try to develop those awareness profiles, you know, the training, the procedures, and the protocol. Remember, it's not a procedure unless it's written down. Mm-hmm. And so writing these things down are very important for any vessel, so you know exactly what they are.
Ed, I got to ask you a question right now, because I'm not a military person. Mm. You're the only quasi-military person I have available to me right now.
Okay.
When you were at King's Point, did you have procedures that were written down?
Everything was written down.
Okay.
Unfortunately, everything was written down.
Did you ever have feelings that you needed to rewrite anything that was written down?
That I would need to rewrite? Well, you know, everything evolves. So technology changes, and for me, in a navigational standpoint, you know.
Oh yeah.
So number one, when I was coming out of King's Point and at sea, paper charts would never go away.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to try this chart plotter thing with a radar overlay as a, just see where it goes.
Sure.
Via Coast Guard
And now it's like the complete opposite.
They literally don't print like them anymore.
We're not printing anything anymore.
We don't print them anymore. Yeah, yeah.
The ink gets wet. And, can't read them.
Yeah. And you
can't see, can't see the red little magenta stuff with the red light on.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, but then we also had, you know, I think it was, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, Vespa. It was like everybody would just take your own weather measurements wherever you were and send it in to this core governmental group. And then they would, it begins with a V. I can't think of it right now, but, and then they would kind of send you out your weather map based on everybody else's input. And then you would have to interpolate that information and say, oh, we're going to have a shitty day today or tomorrow's going to be fantastic. And we should probably have everybody out there scraping and painting the deck on a super tanker.
That is some. OK, yeah. So the technology is changing all
so much
the time.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. There's probably more technology now on that sailboat you just delivered, John, than I had on a super tanker 30 years ago. I mean, in their phones. Like, we didn't have cell phones when I was on a super tanker 30 years ago. And there's more navigational information on that than, you know, a lot of boats had back then. So, yeah, things change and, you know, policies and procedures change. And typically for the better, but yeah, Kings Point, everything was written down. You know, but as John was alluding to earlier, you know, procedures are important. Practice is important because, I mentioned this before that, when you're in an emergency situation, when you can't panic and the calmness is what gets you through it and that muscle memory kicks in, and you've practiced something multiple times, how to retrieve, maybe not the actual retrieval of a person out of a boat, but the steps, you know, what's next. Okay. Yeah. Next thing I need to do. Okay. We did that. Okay. Now I need to get some sort of strap down so he can stand on it and stabilize. And now we need to do this and position people this way, because I already know if all three of us are standing right here, we're just pulling somebody over the same damn stanchion that does not help anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all just practice makes perfect, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, practice is, or what is it, smooth is slow, slow is smooth is fast. And
it depends on what branch you were in.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Oh, don't you dare go there. Don't you dare go there. Look, I'm pretty sure the military is not listening to me right now, but I hope they do someday.
Yeah. Well, you know I'm former Army, right?
I do know that. Oh. I know you're an interesting critter. I know there's a reason why
is
major
golf game
is so good? Well, his golf game is amazing.
I didn't say it was Air Force. That's my brother.
His golf game is amazing.
I'll tell you, his first I'm in Kabul. My brother's off somewhere else. He's Air Force. His first phone call to me was, "Hey, where do you guys get your air conditioners?"
Okay, but look, John, you are a fascinating character in this floating space, is what I'm gonna call it, because I have people that know you and they are super excited that I know you, and then they glom on to me and they go like, "Oh my God, you know John? That's amazing." Yeah. And then I have people that go, "Oh my God, you know John? I hate him."
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, and I say, take a number, get in line.
Right. And it's because you're a hardliner. It is what I'm going to call it. You are a hardliner when it comes to safety procedures, and you're intolerant of what came before.
Yeah.
So if something was the process before and it's not considered as effective anymore, you do not accept it anymore.
No.
Why absolutely not.
I mean, I love technology. There's great things we can do to keep people safer with technology. And that's it. I mean, the hardest, I had a situation, well, when the owner comes on a boat and he wants to be barefoot, and it's like, "Yeah, well, guess what? I'm your skipper. Mm. Clothes show
closed-toed shoes. I don't want to go ashore because you cut your foot and did that, and that's it. I mean,
yeah, if somebody bleeds out from their toe, that's real embarrassing. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I get this guy. Well, you know, I've always sailed barefoot. And it's like, oh, I guess you've always done it wrong.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's simple things like that. I mean, you know, owner's going to jump on board a boat and I'm doing a delivery. He's like, I want to get on for one of the legs. It's like, yeah, not a problem. Oh, by the way, here's the four rules of teamwork. You need to read these before you come on the boat.
Oh,
and I'm
wow.
sending that to the owner. So I send him the four rules of teamwork because, you know, a lot of it is important on how I run a boat and I develop team. And as a skipper, that's your job,
mm-hmm.
is to develop a team after every day. Hey, what'd you guys learn today? Provide that. You know, what are we missing? Asking questions like that are very, very important. As a leader, I'm stealing this from my brother. Your job is really broken down into two elements. The first one is to give clear instructions and set expectations.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the second one is to manage risk. I agree with him 100%. As a leader, if there's a couple things we can do, I think that's really, really important if you break it down. And by doing that, I set the rules of teamwork, and we go from there. There are four simple rules. It's easy.
Yeah,
it's on there. Like for learning about incidents, what I've done recently is, you know, there's a lot of sailing incidents that are out there around the world, and they're here and they're here, and all the write-ups are there. So the UK has theirs, the MIAB's got theirs, you got the you got Spanish got theirs, you got the New Zealanders have theirs, Australia has theirs. So what we've done is we've downloaded all of those and we put that on our website as a global incident base, so you can go through all the different sailing incidents and the lessons learned all in one place. And then the other thing we've done is we've taken those procedures and checklists. And, I got a bonanza worth of checklists. You need a checklist? It's on Word. Just download it. It's there. Make it yourself. One of them says, don't forget to feed the cats. Just to make sure people read it, you know?
Right.
Okay. I'm always obsessed with your checklists. I love them when I'm going offshore. I use them all the time. However, how the heck did you become Mr. Safety Standards when you were literally Mr. Good Times in Lake Geneva?
Oh. Well, the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
Okay, please explain. Please explain. Because I am having a hard time with it.
All right. So one of the reasons I excelled in the military is as we're traveling around the world with all the officers, I worked in G3. So I was always in plans and operations. And I was like kind of the op sergeant there with the master's degree. So I had the same exact education that the officers, which is weird. I tell people it made me the most dangerous man in the military. I could get them home at night because I have this sixth sense. If I've been somewhere, I know how to get home. And so I would always be able to get everybody home.
I have that.
Yeah.
I have a weird, I always know which direction is north.
Yeah. Well, I have that too, but it's only because I ate a lot of refrigerator magnets as a kid.
Oh, man. Maybe that's why.
And now they're stainless steel. Kids don't have that anymore.
Oh, man. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, for me, it was nothing. I mean, I've used, you know, celestial navigation one night in Sudan, walking down the paths in the middle of a war between North and South, using Orion. Well, we got to go that way, so let's go. Gotta go. Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you some ugly questions about testing your processes for pulling bodies out of the water.
Mm.
You literally film pulling bodies out of the water, and I think I've even seen you be the body.
Oh yeah. Well, you know what? You might find this hard to believe, but this skipper, when I'm giving tasks out, I clean the heads.
Good for you.
I won't ask my crew to do anything that I myself won't do. And although it might take a little effort to keep down lunch,
right?
It's also the smallest room in the boat. Yeah. And you know, I have a secret. You know, that shower nozzle works magic.
I'm with you. You don't ask your crew to do jobs that you wouldn't do yourself. However, okay. Well,
so I'll do it. Absolutely.
You know what? Actually, I'm going to tell you a story that I shouldn't tell. Uh-oh. This should be an after hours that we're going to put on the Patreon, but I'm going to give it to y'all right now. Once upon a time when I was maybe 21 years old, as a skipper of a vessel in New York Harbor, having a bunch of 16, 17 year old cadets on board, I decided they needed a real life man overboard drill, and so I went overboard. Uh-oh. I was wearing a life jacket, and they did a phenomenal job. They picked me up in 20 seconds. I was literally going, one Mississippi, two. They did an amazing job, but I was so tired of, I had this same crew for 8 weeks at this point, and they were bored, and they didn't believe me that this was a real thing that they needed to train for, because we were just throwing fenders overboard. Mm-hmm. They were tired of it. And so I literally went overboard myself with a life jacket on. I would have been fine. We were in a perfect position for it, except for the fact that I'm pretty sure I have, you know, all kinds of diseases from the Hudson River. Yeah, my husband's, you know, he's got like X-Men powers.
Which exact ones would those be?
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just full of Hudson River power.
Well, you're never going to get sick. You got every immunity in the world.
And
I'm sure that river comes with drug injections too.
So literally, though, I had these young guys who picked me up within 20 seconds. They did the most amazing man overboard drill I've ever seen, ever. And I'm proud of them. But I also felt like in that moment, if it had been anybody else on the crew, they would have looked to me to tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And it almost had to be me that went overboard for them to actually do the drill, as opposed to anybody else going overboard. They would have looked to me to tell them to start the drill. And I was stressed about that. I was worried about that. And I didn't know how to train that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's tough. Okay. So I can't recommend putting anybody who's not trained on how to manage themselves in the water to go in the water. All right, there's a lot of training that goes with that, so I can't recommend that. So the second best thing is going to be two fenders and 2 5-gallon buckets.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so 2 fenders and 2 5-gallon buckets will come very close to simulating what it's going to take to get those things out of the water. All right, and that would be a person that would be incapacitated and they can't help themselves. All right, and I think that's the best way to practice. And the other tools that are going to be very important for people to have is, of course, the life sling that drags behind the boat.
Yeah.
All right. If you do have a man overboard, you want to leave a trail of breadcrumbs. Anything that floats, throw it off the boat.
Litter the area with flotation.
It does two things. It gives you a trail back to the person. And number two, it will protect the person from other boats when other people see things in the water. And that's also going to be important. You're going to have a throw line that you can throw to them that is separate from what you're dragging. You're going to have a throw ring, or the throwable device has to be there. Now, here's the special stuff. Having a whistle on that throw device is going to be important, and a light is also going to be important. All right. When you get into racing competitions, there's a man overboard module that you can deploy, which is a floaty little thing. It has a 3-meter pylon on it with a light that flashes at night.
That thing is so cool.
And if the person, some of them, you can just hook it up to a halyard and hoist them right up. There's a lot of good ways to do that too. But finally, the magic. Smoke. Day or night, day or night, always have a smoke can. Most of the pro boats that you see racing today are going to have a can of smoke sitting back there. Day or night, you can see that. All right. And so those are the magic ingredients. If you get to that level, then you're covering your bases because you've done a lot of things. Not only are you practicing those procedures, you're thinking about what that's going to be like, but you're adding redundancy in so many different ways to get people a chance and an opportunity. The likelihood is like, you know, you got a person in the water. It ain't 100% they're coming back. And then the question is, how are you going to communicate that person in the water to other boats that are around? So that's part of the procedures. Do you do a mayday? Do you do a pan? My advice, it's a mayday. A life is in jeopardy.
Life is in jeopardy.
Yeah. 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 A life is in jeopardy. So that's what I recommend. And that's on every boat that I own. And that's on every single boat I deliver. And it has that. And if they're not on there when I get on it, it's like one of two things is going to happen here. Give me your credit card. We're going to go get it right now, which I just had to do. Or, yeah, the boat is not ready and I'm here. You're off the schedule.
You're not on my delivery list anymore.
Yeah. And that's why I get 50% up front. And the contract is, if the boat is not ready to go when I get there, there's a small likelihood, you know. But if I got to start turning wrenches to get this thing to go.
Right.
Yeah. This captain's not going to be in a happy place.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I never have a time frame. I will not deliver a boat on a schedule.
Mm-hmm. Lordy, lordy. Anytime I've been a delivery captain, I have had a clause in my contract that has said, if I do not deem this vessel to be seaworthy, I'm not playing ball.
Even when I'm training, you know, I'll step on people's boat and I'll train them. All right. And so my first 3 hours on their boat is nothing but safety. And I'm going through everything with their boat. I mean, if it needs to, the diagrams alone of the seacocks, all right? You have a diagram, because I hope you do, but not only with the diagram, there should also be a spreadsheet labeled starting in the front, one to whatever, how many they are. So if you have a water intrusion, you can go from one to another in an organized fashion and go through the list so you can check them out. So those are real important lessons learned.
The diagrams are amazing and I wish I had them on more boats. I don't always get them. Ed.
Yeah.
This is my friend John.
Yeah.
Hey, John. He's a spicy mariner.
Right.
I'm gonna let him go though very soon.
Okay.
Do you have any questions?
Not really questions. I will say I am actually surprised because safety, I would say safety wise, we're probably not similar background, but I have a strong safety background in open water situations. I'm surprised at how many of the sailboats that I broker that actually come pretty close to checking a lot of those boxes. And I'm really, really surprised, you know, like they have their manual. And of course, your first thought, well, oh my gosh, these guys barely think. But you start flipping through and you're like, this is some really fantastic. Like on the sales side of things, it really helps me say, hey, not only is this considered a blue water cruiser, clearly the captain, the owner of this boat also sees it that way because they've taken the time and energy to record through hulls, storage spaces, where everything is located, safety equipment, checklists, dates. Like, and typically also it's, you know, you find out, oh, the owner's an engineer of some sort.
There you go.
NASA. Or a surgeon or something that's very extremely detail oriented.
It gives you confidence, doesn't it?
Oh my gosh. So much. I mean, and that's not even me taking the boat out. It's just selling the aspect as a broker of selling the boat. It's like, yeah, it's been through its paces. Like this is what, and you've done that for some of my associate brokers. You've done deliveries and, you know,
clearly they had all their things because you did the delivery.
Yeah. Or I'm bringing my own.
Yeah, right.
I got the heavy bag.
I do have a heavy bag as well.
I bring a splice kit. I'm an idiot. I bring rolls of Dyneema and a splice kit.
That's insanity. Okay. This has been the Funny Bone Podcast. I am not talking Bon Voyage. I am not talking about all the stuff that I'm not bringing on deliveries. That's insanity.
I got one funny story from the last delivery.
I bet you do. Okay, this is where I'm going to tell you. You have to join our Patreon or our membership or whatever. And we're going to talk to John about your Illuminati membership, Shelby.
Skull and bones.
Okay, yes. We're gonna keep recording, but we're not letting you into it unless you're part of our
Become a Patreon and listen to.
Is this hypnosis?
You'll be popular.
All right, wait. What were you gonna say? All right, I'm sorry.
Can I do a giveaway?